Good morning and welcome to Great Loop Radio, brought to you every Friday morning at 10 a.m. by America's Great Loop Cruisers Association. AGLCA and our Admiral sponsors, Barber Marina, Curtis Stokes & Associates, Dog River Marina, Dozier's Regatta Point Yachting Center, Dozier's Waterway Guides and Magazine, and Skipper Bob Publications invite you to join us as we explore the Great Loop every Friday morning with a show chock full of information that's useful to you, whether you are dreaming of, in the midst of, or planning a trip around the Great Loop. And don't forget to visit our ship store at www.greatloop.org, ship store. Thanks and enjoy the show.
Welcome to all our listeners out there. This is America's Great Loop Cruisers Association weekly blog radio segment. I'm Janice Cromer, and I'm the director of AGLCA, and Steve Cromer, who is excellent in the technical side of it and in customer service, is with us also. For those non-members out there, the Great Loop is the continuous waterway that includes the eastern portion of North America, which is the Atlantic and Gulf Intracoastal Waterways, the Great Lakes, the Canadian Heritage Canals, and the inland rivers of America's heartland. AGLCA, as we like to call ourselves, is an organization of people who share the sense of adventure and curiosity about America's Great Loop. Our primary purpose is to get you information and enhance the overall experience. Our website is www.greatloop.org. If you're not already a member, we'd love for you to visit and join. There's also a host of information under Frequently Asked Questions and Other Treasures. Please get familiar with our webpage. Our guest host this week is Gold Looper, Chuck Gorgon. Chuck and his wife, Claria, completed the loop in 2008. They have cruised extensively since then, and Chuck will tell us about their recent trip from Florida Keys to Boat Buford, South Carolina. He'll put a special emphasis on national parks that our cruisers may not be aware of. If anyone would like to call in during the show with a question or a comment, we'd appreciate hearing from you. The toll-free number is 877-497-1815. Chuck, good morning, and thanks for being with us today.
Morning, Janice. Glad to be here.
Thank you. Why don't you start with giving us an overall, where did you go and when did you do your trip?
Well, I think maybe before I do that, as the loopers leave Florida and start north, they're going to come into some waters that they're unfamiliar with as they get to the North Florida and Georgia into South Carolina marshlands. Also discover that the tide range, once they get to St. Augustine and as far up north as Wilmington, North Carolina, increases to a maximum of 8 feet as they pass through the Savannah area, about the middle of those cruising grounds. This does several things, and what it does mostly to those of us using the waterway is it makes some of the rivers and creeks that we travel through that make up the intercoastal waterway somewhat challenging. And what makes them challenging is that they have soft bottoms. As this water moves in and out with tidal current as high as 2 miles an hour, it tends to move those channels around a little bit, and the charts that we're using have not kept up to date.
Ah.
So the bottom line is, don't follow your magenta line. You will find that your chart plotter at times will actually have you in the marshes. And the chart plotter knows exactly where you are, and they are dead nuts correct. The problem is the charts have not been updated to agree with what you're finding on your chart plotter. So the rule of these soft bottom channels, and it is, I've found it true to be every time, the outgoing current is the stronger of the two currents of the incoming and outgoing, and it tends to cut the deepest channel. So as you're going up these channels, you want to tend to stay to the outside of the curves as the tide would be running out. Sometimes you'll even find that the incoming tide cuts a deep channel on one side, the outgoing cuts a deep channel on the other side, and the shallowest part of the creek or river is actually in the middle.
The middle of the channel.
So people, think, boy, I'm right in the middle of the channel, and they run aground. Well, that's why. And don't be afraid to run the channels at low tide. When the water goes down and you can start seeing the banks underneath the marsh grass, you can see where the channel is. You'll see on one side a rather steep bank, on the other side a very sloping bank. You obviously want to be on the side nearest the steep bank. And we recently on our trip went through the Little Mud River, one of the places everybody fears, at dead low tide. And it was very easy to stay in the channel and find nothing less than 6 feet of water through the whole thing. And had we been on the Magenta Line, we would have been in the mud. And so at higher water, if you're following the Magenta Line, you would have probably been running in 4 feet of water and maybe churning some mud and not been very happy. The other thing that I'd like to chat a little bit about is anchoring in these same conditions. Especially in Georgia, as you come through Georgia, there are many lovely anchorages in the marsh system. And they're just all over the place. And you'll find them in Skipper Bob's book, and you'll find them listed on Active Captain. But as you anchor in these situations, you'll be anchoring in currents that approach 2 miles an hour. And if you're not careful, you can actually pull your anchor out as the tide turns. And we live on a tidal creek ourselves, and we see this not with a lot of frequency, but occasionally somebody will anchor for the night, and during the night, the tide will turn, and they'll pick their anchor up with a rod and drag it down the creek a ways, and they'll be in a different spot than they started. So what we do, and we're very conservative about this because we really don't want to be bothered in the middle of the night, we put two anchors down. We've got two anchors set from our bow. We set one at the time we anchor up current, so to speak. We let the boat drift down a long ways, double the scope that you would normally use, set the second anchor, and then we back the boat back up towards the first anchor and pull the first anchor line in some and let out on the second anchor and set the second anchor and then end up cleaning both off with some slack, but virtually very little at midpoint between the two anchors. And we spend the whole night there without ever worrying about going anyplace. And it might be a little conservative, but we've never gone anyplace once we've anchored.
I think it's always better to be conservative than to take a chance. Dee's philosophy is the same.
Well, yeah, you know, we can all set our anchor alarms, and, you know, at 3 o'clock when they go off in the morning, you know, you don't really want to get up and deal with a problem.
No.
Okay, so with those thoughts, and as our boaters start moving north, there's a couple of national parks down in the southern part of Florida, one being Everglades National Park and the other Biscayne Bay National Park. Let me make a few comments about Everglades. For those boaters that are still up in the Fort Myers area and are going to come down through the Keys as they come home, this park is got its northern visitor center up at Everglades City. And Everglades City is kind of the first stop that people would consider after they leave Marco Island. Itself, you can't get to the visitor center with your boat. You probably get there with a dinghy. But inside Everglades City, there's a delightful old inn called, why can't I think of it right offhand? Rod and Gun Club. The Rod and Gun Club is an historic inn that was built back in the days of developing South Florida in the 30s. This was intended to be the Miami of the West Coast. Of course, that never happened, but this old Rod and Gun Club still exists pretty much in its original form. They have no computers inside. You can't pay with a credit card, but it's kind of a delightful place, and they do have a nice restaurant. From there, you can walk down a little bit south to the visitor center and pick up brochures on the park and learn about some of the waterways through the park. And there is actually a waterway called the Wilderness Waterway that runs from Everglades City all the way to Flamingo down at the far south end. Now, we can't take our big boats down that. You'd have to have a very small boat to do that. So most of us then go back into the park and anchor at the Little Shark River. And most of us use this only as an anchorage to get to Marathon or the Keys. We decided on this last trip to go up the Little Shark River a reasonable distance. Turns out we probably could have gone further. And we had discovered an active captain that somebody had been all the way up into Tarpon Bay. Well, that's about 12 miles up into the park. We took our 43-foot boat about 5 miles up into the park, just shy of what they call the Shark River Chicky, and anchored for the night. And, just delightful. If you like bird watching, you like watching some manatees swim around, and nobody else there, this is one of the places. And as I say, what you could do even from there is I looked at the charts, and there should be no problem getting all the way up to Tarpon Bay if you wanted to go that far up. If you have a dinghy with a reasonable motor on it, and I'm speaking now about, a dinghy that will get up and plane, you can do parts of the Wilderness Waterway from a point about 5 miles up the river and get on this Wilderness Waterway. If you have one of their charts that you can get at the park office, then it would be quite easy to use. It turns out that it's all buoyed and marked, and so it looks like you shouldn't get in too much trouble running, maybe 10 miles either direction on the Wilderness Waterway with your dinghy. It ought to be a delightful trip. Haven't done that yet, but would recommend looking at that as a possibility. Then from there, we went down into Flamingo. Now, Flamingo is the south visitor center. It is accessible by boat. When Hurricane Wilma came through back in, I think it was 2007, they got quite a bit of damage down there, and so the channel for a while was somewhat impassable. It appears that they have dredged it some, and it is now pretty much as charted at 4.5 feet. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of water, but you kind of have to get used to that as you cruise through these southern waters and Florida Bay especially. 4.5 feet of water is plenty. It's a very soft bottom. So we took our boat in there without any trouble. We draw 3.5 feet. It turns out that in Flamingo, the chart, you have to favor the green side a little bit, and that's posted on Active Captain. There's two red marks that if you cut that corner, you find that it's only about 3.5 feet deep. And we did that the first time and said, ooh, this isn't so good. We talked to the guys that run the tour boat, and they said, oh, yeah, you got to stick to the green side, and we did that on the way out, and that worked fine. So in Flamingo is a very active visitor center, lots of ranger programs, which we participated in, bird watching and all. They have a very nice marina, at the moment not maybe managed as well as it could be, but good dock systems, power, water. And I can't remember, I think they charged us $1 a foot to be in there.
Unbelievable.
It isn't very expensive. As I say, the services weren't great. They wouldn't respond to the radio. They wouldn't respond to a phone call. And so we weren't sure going in there what we were going to find when we got in there. Well, we found we were the only boat. We were the only boat because everybody else probably says, well, nobody's going to answer the phone or the radio. I guess we better not go in. And supposedly that's going to change of interest. I talked to one of the rangers, one of the head rangers there, and they said, yeah, we're going out for bid for a new contractor to run the marina. And
really?
We hope it improves. So, okay, then from there, of course, you can easily get now back down to the Intercoastal Waterway.
The ranger program's wide there, too.
Yeah, well, my wife just said make sure you use some of the Ranger programs. They have an evening program every night. They have a big screen, believe it or not, and a computer-generated projector. So you sit outside and look at a big screen and listen to the program. It was wonderful, delightful. We enjoyed it.
Interrupt for a second, Chuck. I hear Claria is there. Hi, Claria. Thanks for being with us.
Hi there.
Good to talk
just,
to you.
Just making sure Chuck doesn't miss anything.
Thank you.
And we just, did. I have my National Park passport, and I got it stamped while we were in Everglades and Biscayne National Parks. And we also did the ranger programs that were there, and they were really good. Key to this area. So. Okay, go ahead, Chuck.
All right.
I think Steve has a caller. Steve, do you have someone who has a comment?
I do. We have Mike on here who has a question.
Okay.
Hey, everybody. This is Mike Warlick. Marion and I and Midas are golden are on the downhill for starting the loop about this time next year. Still got a lot of stuff to do to the boat to get it ready, but it'll go quickly, I'm sure. But I had two questions, and one I just posted on the forum, but I'll throw it out here too. The first question is concerning electric bikes. We have a 38-foot main ship, 38-foot marine trawler, and it has a very high aft deck. Low swim platform, and also we have a hard top canopy that goes over the aft deck, which would be ideal for storage. What we're looking at is, and the question I have is, we've looked at these two electric bikes, and the thinking is, what if we come to a place like a park or something that's near the loop, and it's within a 20-mile round trip, would the bikes be worth it? Mary and I ride regular bikes, but we're thinking the electric bikes might give us a little advantage if we had to haul a few supplies back. And this is, I guess, a question for a seasoned boater that's been on the loop a couple of times, but how many times would it be convenient to have a electric assisted bike to go grab some groceries or to go visit a park somewhere or just get exercise in general?
Well, I guess I'll comment. We have fold-up bikes, pedal-driven fold-up bikes.
Yeah.
One of the problems that many people have with bikes is being able to properly store them. And it's amazing where salt spray can get to. It's just amazing. Salt spray gets everywhere.
Yeah.
And if your bike isn't a marine-grade bike, and it doesn't make any difference whether it's a pedal bike or whether it's an electric bike, it's going to get rusty. And we're using the Port Runners that West Marine sells. We bought them 7 years ago now. They've been amazing at how well they've stood up and keep going. We use them a lot. We use L.L. Bean bags, and with two big L.L. Bean bags and then a couple of long hanging bags that we hang off the handlebars up front, it's amazing how many groceries we can get back to the boat.
And use shock cord.
And use shock cord to keep them on the little
right.
things that they have. We do not have baskets. Like a lot of people have, we can actually fold our bikes up and put them underneath a rear storage seat that we've built into our boat, and they completely disappear and they're in bags, and we've had no problem with rust or anything on them. And one of the keys is having a really good indoor space to store these things. Otherwise, you're going to find they're going to rust up. I mean, even if you put them under a back hardtop that isn't completely enclosed, you're going to end up with rust.
Right.
And So keep that in mind, too. You know, we feel comfortable riding up to probably 5 miles for groceries on our regular bikes. And then when we don't have groceries and we're going to, you know, maybe to a park or something, we'll maybe bike up to 7 miles each way. Beyond that, it's starting to get to be a little
right.
bit for us that are in our mid-70s.
Thank you, right. Chuck. Does that answer your question, Mike?
Yeah, I think that does. The bike I'm looking at is called a Mariner 12. It's made by a company called Prodeco Technology, and but they're a little pricey. They're about $1,000 for each for the bike. They will get up to about a 20-mile. You know, they have a little a very compact battery. Pack on the back of the back of the seat, but they'll get up to about a 20-mile. And you know, you don't use the you pedal. Idea is to get exercise too, but
yeah.
But anyway, excuse my other phone.
Thank you. Okay, but, Chuck, why don't we get back to the Pennekamp State Park?
Yeah,
I think Mike had another question.
Well, the other question, I guess, it concerns a davit system that we need a davit system for this boat. And right now I'm leaning towards a Weaver system. I have a swim platform on the back with a ladder that goes up to the aft deck. There's a little door, swinging door, that you go enter the aft deck from the swim platform on this ladder. I've got the dinghy tied up on the swim platform now, but I want a davit system that's easy to get this boat in the water. And also, I made a mistake and got, I think, too big an engine. It's a 80-pound, 9-horsepower motor, which will actually plane our dinghy, but I got it now. Don't know. We were discussing whether to sell it and get a smaller, you know, a little lighter one, horsepower, or just keep the one we have. So I don't want to haul this motor up. I want to keep it down. And one of the Weaver systems allows you to lift the engine and keep it vertically on a transit hoist. I don't know if that makes sense or I'm saying that right, but in other words, as you bring the dinghy, as you hook the dinghy and hinge it to the back of the swim platform, and then you fold the dinghy up on its side, the motor will actually come off and stay vertical on that right there, and it'll do the reverse when you lower the dinghy back in the water. So, but if there's another, you know, we have a high back from the swim platform up to the aft deck. It's 9 feet, not 9 feet, excuse me, about 6 feet, and so I just wondered if anybody had any suggestions about davit systems I should be looking at.
Mike, I think your questions probably are better suited to the forum if you're asking for a lot of opinions. If
okay.
either you are, I would post that. There has been a lot of chatter about systems in the forum, so you can search the archives and
okay.
post another question to the forum. That would be my advice for you.
That's probably a bit, good suggestion, so
okay,
let me
thank
do that.
You.
All right.
Chuck, do you want to talk a little bit about Pennekamp State Park?
Yeah, and the next thing you're going to need to really see the next two parks, because the water gets crystal clear and you end up on these beautiful coral reefs, is some sort of a device or the ability to go snorkeling. We can't get in and out of our dinghy very easily, so we decided to buy a glass bottom bucket. Now, this is nothing more than a 5-gallon bucket with a piece of plexiglass across the bottom, And you take and just set it in the water, and now look over your dinghy side, and you can see the bottom. We happen to have bought ours at Worldwide Sportsman in Isle Mirada, which is a phenomenal
recommended
stop. Anyway, it's the first store of Bass Pro, and they got everything there, let me tell you. So anyway, we got our glass bottom bucket there, and our intent was to go out to the Dry Rocks reef on our way up the coast.
All right,
and see the reef down there. Well, it turned out it was kind of a rough day, and so we had to pass on that. But so we went straight up to Biscayne National Park. But there's some beautiful reefs in John Pennycamp, which is a state park.
How are you doing?
Have we got somebody on the line with us?
I hear someone in the background. I'm not sure where it's coming from.
I think
Steve has it under control.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Mike was still on there jabbering about something.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right. I think he was just talking to somebody else in the background.
Okay. Well, let's go with Dry Rocks Reef then, Jack.
Okay. All right. Well, anyway, so there are several reefs to look at, but probably the reef, if you're going to look at a reef, is Dry Rocks. And that's where the statue is down in the reef, and you can see this statue of, I'm not sure exactly what it is, but there is a statue that's been placed down there, and apparently the coral has grown on it, and it's supposed to be gorgeous.
Beautiful.
We can't tell you specifically about it because we haven't done it, but and that's one of the things we missed, and we would recommend if you've got a nice calm day and you want to run outside up Hawks Channel and then work over to that reef on the outside of Hawks Channel and take a look. They've got buoys out there. We know that. You tie your boat up, your big boat, to a buoy, put your dinghy down, and you can dinghy over the top of these reefs. And with your glass bottom buckets, you can just sit there and look at it. It's got to be phenomenal.
Okay, we need to break for a quick commercial, Chuck. I'm sorry to stop you, but Steve, can you go ahead and play our commercial, please?
Okay.
Sure can.
AGLCA Admiral-sponsored Dog River Marina is located at the mouth of the Tenton Waterway in Mobile, Alabama, only 22 miles from the Gulf of Mexico. The marina encompasses 95 slips, 80 of which are sheltered. They offer a ship store, courtesy car, rental cars, 24-hour guard service, and shore power. The complex's full-service repair facility is staffed with highly trained personnel to handle everything from simple repairs to complex overhauls. For more information, visit www.dogriver.com.
Thank you. Chuck, we've already run a half an hour. What I'm going to ask you to do, if it's okay with you, we have 15 minutes left that we can spend. Can you go through the Biscayne National Park? And I'm going to invite you back for another show to go through the rest of your outline, which everybody listening out there, Chuck has about 12 stops that he recommends as you go from Florida to Beaufort, South Carolina. And I'll schedule a show, hopefully, with Chuck to go through them in the next week or two.
Well,
Chuck, why don't you tell us about Biscayne National Park?
Yeah, well, the other thing I could do on those other 12 is I could redo my post that I tried to do on the AGLCA forum and put a comment about them, and maybe that's the way to do them.
We'll talk offline about that, but you're just so interesting to listen to. But I'll be in touch. Let's go with Biscayne National Park.
Well, we ran up the inside, and we went up to Caesars Creek. You can get into Caesars Creek, which is at the south end of Biscayne National Park, either from the Hawks Channel outside or from the inside. I think the channel coming in from the outside is very straightforward. You get into this kind of little basin. Adams Key is there. Adams Key has a campground on it and a park dock. We anchored a little off to the left of Adams Key in a narrow channel. I guess I don't have the exact keys, but it's very obvious, and Active Captain shows that anchorage. It was a relatively narrow channel. We put our two anchors down so that we could make sure to stay in that as the tide changed. We put our dinghy down. we took our glass bottom bucket and we went into the little creeks of the mangrove islands, and it was just fascinating. All the fish life that's down there, and these pristine waters, it was just delightful. So we spent the night there, and then the next day we went back into Biscayne Bay, and there's two channels that go from Caesars Creek into Biscayne Bay. There's a west channel and a north channel. The north channel's got about a foot extra water, depending on the tide state. I would think at low tide you'd have a good 5.5 feet through that channel all the way into the bay. It's a little hokey because you can see the bottom and you think, oh my gosh, I'm in this shallow water, but actually you're just in beautiful, pristine water. So from there we went up to the visitor center. The visitor center is from the land side, is near Homestead, and they advertise a day dock. The channel going in there is advertised at 3.5 to 5 feet. So I called the marina that's in there because we thought we might even go into the marina for the night. I said, what's the deal with the 3.5 to 5 feet? She says, well, at low tide it's 3.5, at high tide it's 5. I said, oh, okay. Well, then we won't be coming in at low tide. Well, the next day at about noon was high tide. So we said, well, let's just take our little 43-foot boat into the visitor center. Why not? I mean, we do those kinds of things. Well, if you go to the park site, it says their day dock is good for 35-footers. But if you don't read that, you don't know that, right? Of course, we knew that, but we're going to be innocent. So I call into the park office, and I get a volunteer on the phone, and I say, hey, we're coming in with our 43-foot boat. Is there room at the day dock? And he says, well, hang on a minute. He gets a ranger on the ranger says, sure, come on in. Well, I don't know if the volunteer said we were coming in with a 43-foot boat or not. So we come prancing into this little narrow channel through the mangrove islands, plenty of water, 6.5 feet of water, and here's the day dock. Well, the day dock, there's some slips that are good for maybe 30-footers. And then in the middle, there's this great big concrete pier that doesn't have anything on it except, you know, some other stuff people walk out on this pier. So I proudly take our boat in and put it on the inside of that, and immediately a guy comes out and says, whoa, whoa, you can't park there. That's a spot for our tour boat, but you can go on the other side. Okay. So I back our boat around, and as I make the final turn, I actually drag our ball pulpit across the mangroves on the far side of the channel.
Oh.
A la 35 feet. But we obviously got in there. We got tied up. We went into the visitor center. They have a video, and we had a pleasant stop there, learned a little bit more about the park, and spent 2 hours there. Felt we needed to get on our way again as the tide turned and it started going down, and because it was a little bit shallow. Our game plan originally was that we were going to anchor the boat near the start of the channel, and we were going to take the dinghy up and see the visitor center. But as long as we had high tide, we kind of said, well, let's just try to take the big boat in. We got away with it. Don't guarantee you'll get away with it again.
They know you now.
Well, yeah. Okay, so then there's two other places that you could normally go in the park. Elliott Key is a main campsite. It's about midway up the park on the outside barrier islands. At the moment, that day dock is closed. They had some damage from Hurricane Sandy, and so that's closed, and so you really can't get in there. But what you need to do, and even if you're not going to do anything else in the park, you need to go to Boca Chica. Boca Chica's the northernmost key of the park. And the keys now, of course, are out on the barrier islands. Well, Boca Chica was going to be the winter playground for the Honeywells from Minneapolis. Everybody knows about Honeywell, I think, you know, because you probably got one of their thermostats in your house controlling your furnace. But anyway, they started out to build this gorgeous mansion in the south, like so many entrepreneurs of the day did. All they got done was their harbor. And then she broke a leg, apparently, and maybe some other complications, ended up passing away. And he never built the home. But they built this gorgeous harbor. I mean, it's a gorgeous harbor. It's got a lighthouse at the end. and it's got a wall all the way around the thing that's got a wood bumper board, and I don't know, you can probably put 30 or 35 boats in there, you know, in 30-foot range. On the weekends, I guess it's getting a little crazy out there now because everybody comes down from Miami, but we were there in midweek, and it was absolutely delightful. So I would highly recommend stopping at Boca Chica. They charge $10 a night, and there's no power or anything, but and then you do have the ability to walk the key. They've got a walkway all the way around the key. There's a little beach on the far side of it, and it's just delightful.
It sounds absolutely beautiful.
Then from there, you're back into Biscayne Bay and heading north. And if I've got just 1 minute, I'll touch one more thing in Miami, and that's Vizcaya. It's now a museum. Vizcaya is near Dinner Key Marina. We went into Dinner Key Marina and then rode about 2 miles or so north into the park. It's run by the city now of Miami. And it is the palatial home that was built by John Deering, another one of those entrepreneurs from Chicago that came down to build his palace in the South. And this thing is, I mean, they bought imported rooms from Italy and European countries, and they brought the whole room over and built it into this phenomenal house. And it's just an indication of the wealth of the time and what some of these northern entrepreneurs did to impress each other. I guess that's the way to
say it. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Well, Chuck, this has been very, very interesting. Claria, thank you for your input.
Yeah.
Sorry we ran out of time, but again, I'll be in touch and we'll see what we can do about your other stops, because I think that would be fantastic. Steve, do you have any questions or any input?
Nope.
Chuck, do you want to end with anything?
No, other than if you're going to do some of these things and you're still down in Marathon and you're going to spend any time at it, time to think about moving north.
Okay. Thank you very much. Everybody, we'll be back next week and have a wonderful week. Thanks, Chuck. Thanks, Claria. We'll see you soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye, all.